I'm Carol Coletta, and this is Smart City. Even America's most depressed downtowns are showing vigorous signs of life. It's a surprising development no one predicted in the bleak years of the 1970s and 80s when many so-called experts dismissed the idea of downtown revitalization as wishful thinking in the age of suburbanization. Dave Feehan, who heads the International Downtown Association, is here to tell us how downtowns have defied predictions and come back strong. Also with us is Dennis Meyer, a sculptor working in Buffalo, who brings new life to abandoned buildings by using the waste of other restoration projects. And we'll hear from Nate Berg at Plan Edison and Walker Smith at Yankelovich with his commentary on the stress of change. That's today on Smart City, right after this news. David Feehan is president of the International Downtown Association based in Washington, D.C. He's devoted more than 35 years to rebuilding and revitalizing cities, directing downtown programs in Des Moines, Detroit, and Kalamazoo, and neighborhood development programs in Pittsburgh and Minneapolis. Dave, unbelievably to me, some people still say that in an America that has been happily sprawling for 50 years, downtowns don't really matter. Make the case for downtowns and why they are important to the success of cities.
I think the case is a relatively simple one in some ways and devilishly complicated in other ways, but the simple answer is this. Downtowns are enormous tax generators for our central cities. The numbers that we're coming up with indicate that downtowns pay anywhere from $10 to $20 in tax revenue for every dollar in services they consume. So if that's true, and we know that residential areas are net tax consumers, we know that the one single factor that makes for a really healthy city, at least in an economic way, is downtown. Now, the work that David Rusk did several years ago in his research pretty conclusively shows that cities with or metro areas with strong central core cities are overall much stronger than those without. So if you have a strong downtown, your chances of having a strong core city are much, much better. If you have a strong core city, the chances of having a healthy metro region are much better.
We've seen remarkable turnarounds in cities across the country, including some really unlikely cities. What led to their revitalization?
I think there were a number of factors that converged, and that's a word that I'm beginning to use more as convergence. But I think what happened was basically this. In the late 80s and early 90s, we discovered that if cities weren't clean, safe, attractive, and friendly, people weren't going to go there, and particularly downtown areas. So the first task was to really tackle that. We were fortunate at the time. What was happening was because of demographics, a strong economy, and other things, crime was dropping precipitously. And we were beginning to see the empty nesters who would populate downtown. So those three factors, I think, the advent of the BID movement, the unprecedented drop in crime, and the beginning of the empty nester phenomenon really fueled the renaissance of a lot of downtowns. However, it didn't happen in all of the cities at the same time. We're seeing just in the last 4 or 5 years, cities like St. Louis and Detroit finally coming around in a big way. But we saw this renaissance in New York and Chicago and other places 15 years ago.
You mentioned the BID movement. Describe a BID and how prevalent is their use today in downtowns?
A BID is really, in some ways, just a financing mechanism. BID stands for Business Improvement District, and it's a special assessment district, but it is put in place and designed by the property owners themselves. City government serves as kind of the conduit to collect the funds and then disperse them back to a local organization, a downtown organization. But these BIDs, or business improvement districts, have spread rapidly not only across the United States and into Canada, but now they're making their way across Europe, and we're starting to see them in Australia and New Zealand. They've become the preferred way of financing downtown revitalization. And the other thing they do, the unexpected thing, is they get the key property owners together around the table on a common agenda. And that's equally important.
Mm-hmm. What do you know about who's living in downtowns today?
Well, what we're seeing, as most people suspect, is that downtowns are rapidly changing from areas where either nobody wanted to live or they were populated by homeless individuals and single room occupancy hotels and marginal housing. What's happened today is that that's been turned on its head. And what we see now is people with disposable income, both on the younger end of the scale, young singles and what we call dinks or dual income, no kids, on the other end of the scale, empty nesters and boomers, and beginning to see even the older folks, senior citizens, choosing downtown as a place to live. But the challenge, of course, is how do you provide affordable housing when rents and the cost of condominiums has gone through the roof?
And how do you do that?
I think there's a couple ways, and we've been doing it for years. We provide incentives for developers to put a certain amount of affordable housing in projects that they would otherwise not include it in. And the other thing is the opportunity to look around the fringes of downtown for areas, brownfield areas, for example, that can be redeveloped where affordable housing can be included as part of the mix. I guess the third component, obviously, is transportation. If we can provide links, good transportation links, for people who live in those close-in neighborhoods in more affordable housing, and they can get into downtown to work in the jobs that are there, that's almost as good as having people living in downtown.
How do cities balance the qualities that attracted downtown's first new residents? Cheap, abandoned loft buildings, the art scene, the authenticity and history that's hard to find in other places, with the development of new towers and chains that seem to follow?
Well, the beauty of downtowns is that they have always been, to one degree or another, places of mixed use and places where different groups of people can come together. But it is proving to be a real challenge because the rents go up, the costs of property go up, and, of course, the artists who can't afford that are being pushed into other areas where they, again, become urban pioneers. Now, there are groups, one in particular in Minneapolis called ArtSpace, that have done a phenomenal job of developing housing with some subsidies for artists to allow them to keep living and working in downtown. But it's a challenge that we don't have a really good answer to yet, and I think you've hit on it. How do you keep the heart and soul, the authenticity of downtown when the development pressures are such that you want to go vertical and you want to build those $1 million and $2 million condos?
Dave, one of the things that I've seen happen in downtowns, I consider it an unfortunate development, is that there's such an eagerness in some depressed downtowns to have new construction, have new development, have new people living there, that they seem to succumb to this notion of if we make it look familiar, if we make it look like the suburbs being built today, then people will move back into downtown. And so then you begin to lose the qualities that made downtown so appealing, the density and the mid-rise nature or high-rise nature, and again that vibrancy that comes from density. I've seen it in several cities. I'm sure you have too. What do you make of that?
Well, I think that particular mistake, if you will, that many cities made, is one that we're now catching on to and not making so often anymore, thank goodness. There were, in fact, as you mentioned, many cities that said, gee, if we could only get a shopping center, let's tear down half of downtown and put a new shopping center in downtown that looks like the suburbs and has stores like the suburbs. Well, imitating the suburbs is the wrong way to go, because if people live out by a shopping center and they can get the same thing in that shopping center, why come downtown? So what we've found is that many cities are now realizing that the urban character, the urban fabric, the urban design is what people want. And that's become extremely marketable. And the converse is happening. Now the suburban developments are imitating Main Street and imitating downtown. And in fact, there's some very good projects going on in the suburbs.
Do you consider that a threat to the trends that you say are converging to result that are resulting in redevelopment of downtowns?
Not at all. As a matter of fact, I think the development of good urban spaces, well-designed and well-developed mixed-use spaces in the suburbs is a very good thing. I'll tell you why. Well, for one reason, it's just more energy efficient. Downtown is the place that is always going to be where you come for the symphony, for the opera, for a concert, for the major events. And it will be the place where people who live in that densely populated area, they'll use that as their neighborhood. But why should someone who lives 15 miles out on the periphery of the city, and they're not going to go away, why should they not have a good urban space to provide for a neighborhood downtown? And so we think that it's actually a good thing, and we encourage good development, good design, mixed use, diversity, all of those things that we know work in cities. We like to see them in those suburban areas because in 50 years, they're going to be historic.
You're listening to Smart City. Our guest is Dave Feehan. He is president of the International Downtown Association. Dave, you mentioned transportation earlier and that many cities are beginning to build transit systems who have never invested in transit before. Some of these seem indeed to be systems. They seem to be metropolitan-wide. They seem to be connected, multi-modes of transit. And then some seem very, single mode, point-to-point, not terribly well thought out and certainly not part of a system. What are you seeing in that area of new transit systems being built around the country, and which cities do you think are really doing it right?
Well, one of the things that we all have to realize is that building transit, particularly fixed guideway transit, is enormously expensive. And so it's very difficult. There are very few cities that can launch and build a complete, let's say, a light rail system all at one time. So I would say that any city that's attempting to do this, my hometown of Minneapolis has just a few years ago opened its first light rail line, which connects the airport Mall of America to downtown. But they're also working on a heavy rail line that would go through and up to the northwest cities and suburbs. So I think any city that's approaching this in a thoughtful way, even if they're only building one line at a time, is doing a good thing. However, if you look at cities like Washington, D.C., which have the real network in place and, in fact, are enhancing that network and building on it, I think you can see how much of a difference this makes. I've worked in Washington now for 7 years, and I've never once driven my car to work on Monday through Friday because I simply don't need to. It's faster, it's cheaper, it's more convenient to take transit. And that's, in the end, what we want to achieve, where transit becomes not only the mode of travel for those who can't afford an automobile, but it becomes the mode of choice for people who can afford it, but find that they can get there better, faster, cheaper, and more conveniently.
It seems that retail has been perhaps the toughest sector to revive in downtowns. Why?
Well, for a number of reasons. One of the reasons is in the suburbs, we have a situation most of the time where retailers are going into a known commodity. They have a developer that they know. They have a property that's under one ownership. Management is not a question. all of those things, they know that they've got the rooftops. All they have to do is crunch the numbers and go ahead and do the project. A downtown offers a real challenge because you've got different codes, you've got different property owners, you have the uncertainty of not knowing who's in charge sometimes. Is there a business improvement district and does it provide additional security and cleaning? All of those question marks that developers and retailers often call this brain damage. And it does make it more difficult to do these projects. So the other side of that is that now what retailers are finding is they're finding that their sales per square foot are oftentimes 50% to 100% higher in some of these urban locations. And therefore, they are going in and even paying premium rents to be in downtown locations. So I think that the difficulty right now is just having a downtown organization really understands retail and understands the importance of the independent shops, the chain stores, putting together a really good mixture in a way that doesn't just look like another shopping center.
How are downtowns faring in the battle for office locations, winning or losing?
I'd say they're holding their own, and if you look at the history over the last 10 to 15 years, in most years, downtowns have a lower vacancy rate overall than suburban office projects. Now, there are some reasons for that. Suburban office developments are always expanding. They're expanding faster than downtown, so there's more space available. On the other hand, what we find oftentimes, and this is anecdotal, but we find office tenants saying, my employees are happier coming downtown because they can get out, they can walk around. If they're in the middle of an office park where they're surrounded by a sea of parking, the only way to go get lunch outside of the employee cafeteria is to get in your car. So we hear that more and more from office tenants. And if you can keep your workforce, you actually save money by not having to hire people as often. So that's, again, another plus for the downtown office market.
What are the big issues in downtown today?
I think the biggest issues right now for certainly for downtown leaders are issues of kind of the where do we go from here? How do we avoid slipping back, and how do we build on the successes we've seen over the last 15 years? The world has really changed. Globalization has changed things. Immigration has changed things dramatically. Workforce development is becoming a huge issue. The whole climate change, global warming, refitting, retrofitting buildings so that they're more energy efficient, those are all challenges. What we thought about 5 years ago and 10 years ago as downtown manager is not what we're thinking about today. Things like clean, safe, attractive, friendly, those are givens. If you don't provide those, you're not even in the ballgame. But we need to be thinking about accessibility. We need to be thinking about workforce development. We need to be thinking about the concept of aging in place. What do we do with the people that are living downtown who are very active in their 60s now, but in a decade or two are going to be in their 70s and 80s? How do we accommodate those? What do we do about the changes in the office market? More people telecommuting. Mm-hmm. All of those.
Yeah, that's an interesting one.
All of those things are going to have a real impact, and I think the value of an organization like IDA is that we can sometimes be that periscope for people who are really in the trenches in their local cities. We can look around the corner, we can look over the wall, and give them some notion of what they might be seeing in 2 to 3 to 5 years.
I'm curious, what do you think, Dave, a downtown organization should do, can do, in terms of workforce development?
I think that one of the things that I would recommend is partnerships with community colleges. I think that's important. I think getting involved with schools is important. And being a part of the civic infrastructure, really working with community leaders to make sure that that next generation of kids, whether they're English-speaking or not, are prepared to come to work.
You did not mention panhandling, but it seems to me that panhandling is actually increasing in a lot of cities, even a lot of strong downtowns. Has anyone figured out what to do about it?
Well, I think there's two things that are really encouraging. One is this. The U.S. Interagency Council on Homelessness had a summit here in Washington just a few months ago. And the results of the Housing First strategy in terms of homelessness have been almost astounding. In many cities, we're seeing a 30, 40, even 60% reduction in the number of homeless people on the streets, the chronically homeless people that you often think of as panhandlers. But the other issue is this. Panhandling is not necessarily an activity of homeless people. There are those who use homelessness as a marketing device for panhandling, and they actually have places to live. So business improvement districts have strongly discouraged people from giving to panhandlers. It's really a supply and demand question. If we educate people that giving to panhandlers is not a good thing to do, if they're alcoholic or drug dependent, all you're doing is feeding a habit. And if they're not homeless, all we're doing is encouraging a behavior that is really not good for our cities and not really a way of providing a respectable occupation for people, then we will see panhandling decline. And I think where downtown organizations have taken an educated and enlightened approach to this, along with organizations like HUD and local housing organizations, we are seeing a decline in both homelessness and panhandling.
What's not working in downtowns? Where are the biggest gaps in where your members want to be and where they are today?
I think one of the challenges that we still see is what to do about retail. You raised that earlier. People still think of downtown as a place to shop, and that's a good thing. Although the statistics I've seen are something like this. In 1950, adult Americans spent 95% of their retail dollars in downtowns, and today that's about 5%. So The reality is we do most of our necessity shopping in suburban areas, in suburban shopping malls and so forth. But the question is then, how do we create an experience that includes shopping in downtown but is wonderful, memorable, something I want to come back for to downtown for? And I think that's a really big challenge. The second challenge is this. We've worked very hard to create 18/7 or 24/7 downtowns where there's always something going on, where there's great nightlife and everything. Well, the thing we didn't realize when we did that was going to create a lot of conflicts, because when bars are open till 2, 2:30 in the morning, when young people are out on plazas and listening to music, for the older folks, that's not such a good thing. You can hear that music blocks away, and you can hear it even if you're 20 stories up in a high rise. So managing the nighttime economy, I would say, is one of the real important challenges. And we work very closely with an organization called the Responsible Hospitality Institute on developing new ways to manage the nighttime economy.
Mm-hmm. What would you say is the most surprisingly successful downtown in America today?
Well, one of them certainly is a place that you're familiar with, Memphis, Tennessee. No one mentions Memphis that often, but I will tell you this. We had a conference there in 1989, and our members said, we never want to go back to Memphis. It's the worst downtown we've seen. We had another conference there about 13 years later in 1992, and it was our highest-ranked conference. People were astounded at the amount of downtown housing, the new downtown ballpark, the number of quality restaurants, art galleries. It was just one of those real surprising turnarounds. So I think that would be one on my list. I think a couple of others that I've seen that are surprisingly changing the nature of their downtowns. Long Beach, California, which used to be kind of a Navy town and a place where sailors would come in for a good time, has become a place where a whole variety of people are now living downtown, where there's great restaurants, plenty to do. That would certainly be an example. And probably one of the most colorful examples is the South Beach area of Miami Beach, which 20 years ago was a place that was crime infested and, you know, really kind of a retirement home for aging residents of New York. But it's become one of the hottest places in terms of retail, restaurant, hotel, and hospitality anywhere in the country, and in fact, an international center of fashion as well.
Dave, have you seen any exciting new concepts for urban amenities that are in the works?
I think one of the more exciting concepts, one of the things that I continually take great pleasure in is this. I have a son who goes to school in Chicago. When people ask me, you know, what downtowns are doing the best in terms of attractiveness, I have to say Chicago is right up there at the top. There's probably few cities that have done as much to really enhance the quality of the urban experience by landscaping and planting, by a whole variety of things, as Chicago has done. I mean, Chicago has always had a fairly lively downtown, but it hasn't been all that attractive until the last 5 years or so. And anyone who hasn't seen Chicago in that period of time ought to go there and take a look. Millennium Park and a lot of the other things that have been on there are really ratcheting up the bar for other cities.
Dave, I appreciate your being on Smart City.
It's been a great pleasure, Carol.
David Feehan is president of the International Downtown Association. The latest news in the world of urban planning, design, and development comes to us from PlanEdison assistant editor Nate Berg.
As the population grows nationwide and the country's available land for urban development dwindles, more and more people are saying, "Not in my backyard." A recent poll by Saint Consulting Group shows that 78% of Americans are opposed to any new development within their communities. More than one quarter of the 1,000 people surveyed also reported they had actually been a part of some activist action to oppose a new project in their neighborhood. CNN reports that even though most people are opposed to any new projects, those most likely to be approved are developments like grocery stores and single-family homes. Those least likely to be approved are landfills, quarries, and Walmarts. Meanwhile, another type of development having trouble getting past a NIMBY-minded public may be a bit surprising. The New York Times reports that many so-called smart growth mixed-use projects are stumbling in Long Island as they are unable to achieve the public support necessary for approval. But it's not the, quote, smart aspects of the developments that are holding them back. It's the fact that the projects are being proposed on such a big scale. With proposals including hundreds of new condos and hundreds of thousands of square feet of retail and office space, many residents and city officials on Long Island are worried that their existing infrastructure won't be able to handle the flood of people that would be sure to follow these developments. Cities across the island, however, are still clamoring for new development, but until the developers can scale their projects down to a more fitting size, the public won't be on their side. And finally, Americans have a well-known reputation worldwide for being fat and lazy. This fact may be hard to dispute, but it has for years been merely a stereotype and an overgeneralization that condemns an entire nation. Until now. A list was recently released of the most sedentary cities in America, redistributing the shame to specific cities and their people. Forbes magazine put together this list by collecting data on TV viewing habits, rates of physical inactivity, and the body mass index of residents in the country's 50 largest metropolitan areas. Their findings show that the country's laziest city is Memphis, Tennessee, followed by New Orleans, Las Vegas, and Detroit. Poor access to grocery stores and public parks, sprawling development, and high concentrations of fast food restaurants are some of the most notable characteristics of the cities on this list, and, not coincidentally, some of the characteristics that make a city recognizably American. For PlanEdison, I'm Nate Berg.
Nate Berg is assistant editor for PlanEdison.com. After a short break, we'll talk with Dennis Meyer about his work as a sculptor in Buffalo, using discarded building construction waste to bring new life to old buildings. Smart City is made possible by the generous support of Memphis Urban Innovators, a collaboration of Memphis business leaders, including the Memphis Tourism Foundation of the Convention and Visitors Bureau, who are focused on bringing smart people, smart ideas, and smart solutions to Memphis and the new economy. You're listening to Smart City. I'm Carol Coletta. You're listening to Smart City. Dennis Meyer is a sculptor working in Buffalo whose work consists of restoration but with a unique quality. He uses the waste of other restoration projects to bring new life to old buildings. Dennis defines his work as afterlives, the attempt to renew and to give another life to the wasted remains of a city. Dennis is an adjunct professor at the University of Buffalo. Dennis, tell me about the work you're doing.
The work I've been doing for the past 5 years is really born out of two trajectories. One trajectory has to do with the long-standing interest in thinking about relationships between painting, sculpture, architecture, and the contemporary city. And the other interest has to do with certain of the less than desirable characteristics of post-industrial places. Specifically in Buffalo, there is an extraordinary amount of construction and demolition debris, and also a kind of plethora of vacancies and neglected spaces. And I'm particularly interested in ways that the first trajectory, that of painting, sculpture, and architecture, might be seen to be enabled or facilitated by the conditions that exist right now in the environment of Buffalo. So about 5 years ago, I was earning my living as a demolition contractor. And I was kind of painting on the side, and I was stunned that one of the situations that young artists often come up against is how to obtain space and also how to obtain material. But it seemed that the conditions of Buffalo seemed to really enable or provide solutions to those problems. So I started to approach demolition or contractors and demolition companies, offering to remove material, and instead of taking that material to the landfill, I would then take it to the studio or really vacant city properties and begin to assemble, organize, and present this material as new installations of discarded city properties. So I began to develop an interest in many of the materials that are often neglected in architecture, things like acoustical ceilings, wood paneling, wood lath, a lot of the stuff that typically has no real intrinsic value to many people and that would ordinarily end up in landfills or on curbsides. And I began to think about, well, what could be done with this? Could there be some way of redeeming this discarded matter and thinking about how it might bring out some of its intrinsic potential properties?
I'm curious how the previous use of, say, acoustic tile influences the way in which you use that tile in artwork, or does it at all? Is it just the nature of the tile itself rather than its previous use that inspires you?
Yeah, well, that's very interesting because there's some acoustical tiles, for example, that have very thick, has very textured, kind of rock-like or crag-like surface conditions. And on the other side, you get this, because of the necessity for fireproofing, you get this very gleaming, silvery, sheening, reflective substance. In the case of wood paneling, because the older wood paneling, they're actually using real wood, it is very thin strips that can be bent, and as they bend, pieces of it begin to splinter and create really interesting, for me, texture, surfaces, all kinds of conditions that we don't. So So I think that it has to do with using the materials in ways that, for which they were not originally intended. That I'm thinking about what are certain properties or characteristics that have been really overlooked in terms of these materials, and how might certain aspects of them actually be brought out in new and possibly significant ways.
I'm curious, does the fact that these are salvage materials from demolished buildings in the urban environment influence your work or the statement you're trying to make with your work?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think that's definitely a big part of it. I think that, well, right now in the city of Buffalo, we have a situation where there are 10,000 properties on the demolition roster. It's a lot of material. It's a lot of... The question for me is, well, to take away 5,000 houses in a three-year period of time, it's an immense amount of material, and it's an immense amount of neglect or emptiness that will subsequently ensue. So I'm really interested in the potential for waste and emptiness to be seen not necessarily as, not explicitly as detrimental qualities, but how might waste and emptiness be brought out to actually be thought about in a new way that might actually be seen to provide an opportunity rather than something to just be kind of plowed over and carted off.
That's an interesting concept, Dennis, waste and emptiness. Now, when you think about that, do you think about it in terms of the spaces that are left? In other words, we demolish 10,000 buildings, therefore we have 10,000 empty spaces? Or do you think about it more in terms of the work you're producing with materials from those demolitions?
I think it would probably be a combination. I mean, I think that there is a possibility to think about how the materials could be reused in many of the vacant spaces. I think that one of the issues I had over a year ago when I was looking for a kind of exhibition venue is that many of the galleries in the city just didn't have the space to handle the kinds of constructions I was making.
Stop right there and describe the size of your constructions.
The size of the constructions are, well, let's see. I would say that most of them begin on a kind of a pallet of, say, two hollow core doors placed together. So you're talking about 8 feet by 8 feet, and they kind of grow out of that kind of framework, often into a space, into a ceiling, between in a corner condition. Other ones are more explicitly or more compressed, so they're more painterly, I suppose, and aren't so much freestanding objects. But the sizes can vary from 20 feet by 10 to 12 feet high to large freestanding objects that actually force viewers to navigate around. In fact, in one of the spaces where I was working, many of the spaces are often for sale, so we get many walkthroughs of potential out-of-town real estate investors, and there were a number of complaints because the investors could not adequately gauge the dimensions of the space due to the material that had been assembled. So, yeah, so some had to be dismantled in order that people could get a better idea of what they might be investing in. There are a large quantity of former manufacturing spaces in the city of Buffalo, very large empty industrial spaces. And I have been thinking about possible occupation of these or re-inhabitation of these spaces using materials that have been gutted or removed from other locations. So it's really about kind of coordinating empty spaces in one place with demolished spaces in another. And this has often involved my needing to negotiate with various kinds of demolition contractors, property owners, and in order to kind of facilitate, okay, I will demolish this for you, but I want to take it here. Okay, you've got to take it here. I'm going to store it for a while, then reassemble it. Then I create a relationship with a gallerist who facilitates the presentation of the material. So there's kind of a network of different kinds of negotiations with various entities that are not really within any kind of what you understand to be within the art world, so to speak, but rather within a kind of various network of city forces of various kind of communities, ranging from contractors to property owners to developers to gallerists and so on and so forth.
When you think about a city like Buffalo, and it's not unlike a lot of post-industrial cities that have buildings whose uses have disappeared, and that they either have to be converted to new uses or torn down, on top of that, you have a shrinking population. So how do you think about addressing this emptiness in scale in a compelling way?
Well, that's a tough one, and it's certainly the question. And I think it comes back to maybe one of the earlier points I was trying to make, is that I have tried to understand certain aspects of the city that that are usually understood as kind of negative qualities or aspects, and to try to think of ways that they might be seen to provide opportunities. And I think that oftentimes in politics the idea is, well, it's bad, so we get rid of it, rather than to think about a way of possibly engaging it, possibly engaging the negative or what is understood to be the negative, and think of what kind of positive or what kind of opportunities might be drawn out of it. That's a kind of broad answer to the question. I think that there are emerging within this kind of environment, an environment like Buffalo, certain initiatives. I'm thinking of Mumford and his call in his later work. He was thinking about these kind of independent urban agents that were able to kind of get together and to tap into the power structure, but to do it in such a way that they were able to realize their own agendas, which had to do with creating communal networks. And I think that is a very interesting model. There is now in Buffalo a building deconstruction industry has emerged, a company called Buffalo Reuse, which actually has a proposal on the table to take down many of these properties and to actually salvage many materials for reselling. So they're working, they have a number of different avenues that enable them to gain funding and so on and so forth. So they're kind of tapped into the city, they're tapped into community, the various communities where they operate. There are other such programs that I think are thinking about this on a very local level. I don't come forward with a proposal that the solution is to tear down the structures and remake them into kind of art. I don't propose it in that way at all. But what I think is that we need to think about alternative ways of engaging the conditions. And that's really, and I hope that what would come out of that are other people that would come forward with other approaches, so that we could think critically about the situation and what might become of it.
Dennis, thanks for being with us on Smart City.
Thank you very much for having me.
Dennis Meyer is a sculptor working in Buffalo, New York. Grounded are you feeling these days? City View's commentator Walker Smith talks about the stress of change.
There is an old saying that there are three things you shouldn't do at the same time: get married, start a new job, and move. Years ago, I worked with a guy who did all three at once. He said his wife came home one day and wanted to know if, unbeknownst to her, they were living in a witness protection program. Now, my 60-year-old friend Roy has done these three things at the same time. Last week, I went to his wedding. Currently, he is between jobs, looking to start a new career. and he and his wife have decided to give up the lease on their condo to move into a bigger house across town. I can tell from his emails that Roy is feeling a little dazed by all the changes going on in his surroundings. But I don't think it's the stress that knocks you for a loop. Stress is a constant in life nowadays. What's tough about these three things at once is that they involve a loss of moorings. When family, work, and home are all up for grabs at the same time, we literally have nothing to fall back on for nurture and support. In effect, if we simultaneously change family, work, and home, we are giving up one community in hopes of finding another. We are without an anchor in life. A lot of us are adrift like this in one way or another nowadays. Contemporary life chips away relentlessly at our connections to community. In the mad rush to keep going, we barely notice, until we are reminded of what we are missing when tragedy comes calling. Try to picture for a moment the worst possible calamity. A crisis so severe that you must leave your home and job to escape it, and in doing so, your family and friends become separated and scattered. In other words, a loss of moorings that is total, catastrophic, and overwhelming. As unimaginable as it sounds, and as hard as it may be to envision what such a tragedy might look like, it is actually quite well known to us. We have seen it more than once. Most recently, right here at home with Hurricane Katrina. When we wonder why we are asked to help defray the cost of rebuilding New Orleans and the Gulf Coast, it is for reasons that transcend the mere economics dominating the current political debate. It is because community is the fundamental underpinning of every human life, and so it is a duty we owe to one another. The three things we shouldn't do at once are not always matters of choice. Sometimes we are thrust into the street, literally and metaphorically, alone, broke, and forsaken. We cannot stand by as others suffer the utter loss of community without diminishing the integrity and authenticity of our own connections. So we must support, even demand, restitution and renovation for others. Otherwise, we turn our backs on the community of others that is our own foundation as well. For City Views, this is Walker Smith.
Walker Smith is president of Yankelovich. He comes to us from Georgia Public Radio in Atlanta, and his new book is Generation Ageless. Join us online at smartcityradio.com to listen to archive shows, sign up for podcasts, and register for our weekly newsletter. Smart Cities web content and audio archive are supported by CEOs for Cities. National distribution is made possible by the Hyde Family Foundations, investing in programs that generate lasting change to improve the future of Memphis, Tennessee, and its citizens. For more information, visit HydeFoundations.org. Eric Rudd is our co-producer and engineer. I'm Carol Coletta.